CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 104, with Dr. Kolev Singh from Stanford. The importance of public health and ophthalmology and really understanding the data from all these studies. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today I have a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. Kolev Singh, who is a professor of glaucoma at Stanford for, believe it or not, the last 32 years. Wow, time flies. Welcome, my friend.
Uday, great to be here. And I got to tell you, it's a huge honor. Your podcast, everywhere I go in the world, people say, do you know Uday Dave? Cataract Coach has changed my life. So terrific. And on a personal note, always so much fun to hang out with you.
Yeah, it was great to see you in Hawaii at the Hawaiian Eye meeting. Thank you so much for actually taking pictures of me getting that award, because otherwise I wouldn't have any pictures.
Well-deserved award. And also in Barcelona, I still remember when we were hanging out in the cab line and people were coming up and doing selfies with you waiting for taxis.
Yes, if someone asks for a selfie, I always say yes. I'm happy to do it. I'm just glad that they're learning from me, and actually I'm learning from them too. But I can't believe you've really been at Stanford for 32 years now?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been the only job I've known since finishing training. And the department's changed, it's grown a lot, but the one thing that hasn't changed is the weather, the lifestyle. overall, when I first arrived here, I just said, man, this is so much better than any other place I've lived. And if there's any way I can stay here and be successful, as someone who enjoys life, it's important to be somewhere where you're comfortable, where you're happy, where you like the people you interact with. And most importantly, if you're an outdoor person, just, you feel like there's stuff for you to do. And here, I think, year round, we have wonderful weather and a great community. The other thing I think I love about the Bay Area and really all of California is you can be from anywhere in the world and you feel welcome here. This is a place that really belongs to everybody. And, It is everybody's second home in many ways. So wherever you grow up, this, you can easily convert this into your first home or at least your second home.
Right. And for you, doing undergrad at McGill in Canada, where you had really harsh winters. Then you did your MB and MPH at Hopkins in Baltimore. Stanford is a beautiful reprise from that.
Well, I'm a native Marylander. I was raised, went to high school in Maryland, and, followed all the Baltimore and sports teams growing up. So for me, if you grew up in that environment, it's not hard. It wasn't painful. And I really enjoyed my time there. But you're absolutely right. This is another world. It's an absolutely different world. And mostly it's about, I think, what we all pay for out on the West Coast is the low humidity, right? And if you could dehumidify the East Coast, there'd be no reason to pay California taxes.
Now, you were at Hopkins, you did an MD, but you also did an extra year for an MPH. And you've been told, or you've told me, that was a very transformational year for you. What did you learn in your MPH that was so amazing?
Well, I think just basic epidemiologic skills, and biostatistics. And just, it gives you this ability to read papers and also to design trials and interpret trials. And, I think that if you get that little extra training early on, then in that small niche, you're often the smartest person in the room for that little thing. And so you often see people who just have, when we're in ad boards and we're in, meetings for societies, everyone brings, beyond their medical training, they all bring a little extra piece of expertise. And sometimes you find that a little extra thing, that a little extra training you get in one area allows you to be defined as someone who knows more than every of those people. Now, I don't know as much as people have PhDs in biostats know, but in the ophthalmology arena, I think it's helpful to provide that perspective as people are looking, particularly when they're looking at future products. And I think that also helped me get more involved with the FDA during my career, because they're also interested in good quality science. So that was a very, very helpful year. I worked a lot with a guy named Al Sommer, who's known as not just as an ophthalmologist, but he's known for his work in vitamin A and won the Lasker Award for that, and went on to become dean of the School of Public Health at Hopkins. So he was an inspiration, and I still keep in touch with Al. Just sent emails back and forth with him last week, and I would say he was one of the key people who shaped my interest in public health epidemiology and led me down that path.
Wow. I mean, that's a probably very important topic that most of us, like me, who just did an MD, I don't have a master's in public health. I had very little exposure to. In med school, it's the epidemiology teaching is on the minimal side. But so we're more concerned with individual teaching or treating one patient at a time. But actually, you're right. Everything we're doing is meant to help a whole society.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, but I would never discount the N of one trial, the one patient right. You have in front of you and what it means to them. But I think what's good about epidemiology in my field of glaucoma is that, and it, you know, there are a lot of we don't have a blood test for our disease. You know, it's right. There's no hemoglobin A1C equivalent. So when you're measuring intraocular pressure or you're measuring what the optic nerve looks like, they are relatively subjective measurements. Now, you know, you might say, well, how can IOP be subjective? Isn't it the same? Every, you know, two people check the pressures in the same. Well, yes and no, right? I mean, it's there can be errors in measurements, and there is a potential for bias in these studies because, say, you do a trial on a particular new surgical procedure, and you don't do a control group, and you know, it, when you're measuring intraocular pressures, the reason you need a control group is that if you're overly enthusiastic, there's not much of a difference between a pressure of 18 and 15, and when you spin the dial, and this is not to imply that people make up pressures, yeah. But you know, I mean, there's a greater likelihood of error relative to when if you're the endpoint you're looking at is someone drawing blood from your arm and sending it to lab and saying this is what the number is,
right?
So that's why I think people want masked observation on these trials. This is also why sometimes you get very, very different results. With the same product in comparative trials versus a single arm case series. And so I think it's been useful to have that epidemiologic perspective when people are assessing products.
Right. I think it's super important. I mean, because even in my clinic, if there's a pressure that's out of the norm that my technician checked, I always say, let me check it myself. Well, I'm using the same device, right?
Right.
Sometimes I'll come up with a little bit of a different, what I think is a different answer.
Well, the other thing to remember is if you check it once and you get and then you get the number, if the technician checks it and they get the number that is a good number, are you just as likely to recheck it as if they get a number that you don't like? And that's the other potential bias. You're rechecking, you know, when you don't like the number. And that, of course, you know, and that's sort of the imperfect world of glaucoma and glaucoma studies, and yet there are ways to fix that and get around potential bias. And again, it's not anybody doing anything necessarily on purpose, but just right. You know, it's just being imperfect, and we all are, right?
Right. I think another thing is I didn't think about until I read what you wrote was we all understand. Okay, a person in the trial can have a conflict of interest financially. But we also may have a conflict of interest because we're just stuck in the old way of our long-held beliefs and we're in the old dogma of thinking, and that may bias our results too.
I think those are the most powerful biases, actually. I think in my own view of what happens in amongst clinical scientists and among scientists in general, if they've been telling you, you know, if this is the way it is for 30 years, and that can sometimes be more powerful than any amount of money. It's because people don't want to admit they're wrong. And I think we've saw this in the cardiovascular medicine literature where people didn't want to acknowledge that, hey, it's not saturated fats, it's carbohydrates that right. are really bad for you. And there weren't, and when there was a switch in the recommendations on food, it wasn't really based on any new trial data. It was really based on people finally like looking at that data and saying, hey, you know, we just wanted to see what we wanted to see all these years. And we tortured the data until it confessed to meet our views.
Oh, I like that. What did you torture the data until it confesses?
Yeah, that's a phrase I sometimes use when I look at some of the post-hoc analyses. You know, when people do trials, they don't come up with what they wanted to find. Sometimes they do post-hoc analyses on subgroups and, you know, and they say, well, every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, if you did this and this and this app group, then my hypothesis is correct. And so what they're basically doing is they're, and of course I'm making this up as an example, but what it does happen that people, yeah. you know, do these post-hocs and So any question you didn't ask at the start of the trial, you have to ask, well, you know, you have to be pressed and be really questioned when you rephrase the, what you're looking at, because there's an infinite number of ways you can look at data. And if you look at it in a way to prove what you wanted to prove in the first place, you can end up misleading the public. And I think we've seen this. You know, one of the biggest misconceptions of epidemiology, and I think you alluded to this, we don't get a lot of training in this for most of our lives, but this idea that if you do a perfect trial, when you have the data, the paper can write itself, like that, you know, that like it's there, you know, you did the trial and here's the data and, you know, like anyone can write this paper. Well, at the end of the day, with no matter how big the trial, there usually are just one or two or three people who look at it at the end, and they're the ones who are going to determine how it's presented.
Right.
And so this potential for bias or people's preconceived notions on what they think a disease is all about, impacting how they present it to the world, it's as powerful as anything else. And so this, just because you do a trial, just because you do a randomized trial, doesn't mean the findings you put out from that trial are reflective of truth. And that's something that I've learned and seen over and over and over again in not just in ophthalmology, but throughout medicine.
Well, that begs the question then, when the trial is over and the data is published or the results are published, shouldn't they have like open access to all the actual data?
Well, that is a great, so I wrote, I think I'd love to, I'll send you this. I wrote a piece on this about, I think about 15 years ago, and submitted it to two of the major journals. Really, it was an editorial saying after a certain grace period where people who did the study should have the control of the data, it should then be made, the raw data should be made publicly available so anyone can replicate the analyses or do alternate analyses. And I got a note back from the editor of a major journal saying, you know, it all sounds great, but none of our reviewers like this. And so it got rejected. And I, you know, it may be time to take that out again, because, you know, I think people have become, there's just a greater interest in transparency on raw data. And now with all the computing technologies we have now available, you could easily rerun a whole bunch of hypotheses. So for example, you know, if you look at cutoffs of what constitutes success, like, you know, it's often arbitrary. Like, you know, you have a huge data set and people say, well, if you look at all the people that had a pressure under 16, this group is better than that group. And you think, well, why did you come up with 16? Why wasn't it 15? Why wasn't it 17? Why?
Yeah.
You know, and the answer is, well, you know, one possibility is the data looked the best to fit your hypothesis if you use that cutoff. And if you had some, you know, AI generated method to just look at what it looks like with all of the different hypotheses, mm-hmm. and then see, you know, that wouldn't that be the right thing to do? And it seems like it's easier now than ever before to do that.
Oh, I think it absolutely is. But again, we actually need the data, though. That's the catch. And then a lot of times there is just a subconscious or even conscious bias that, all right, we're so invested in this trial. We have so much time and effort and dollars put into this trial. This better work. This better show something. So if we can't show it at you know, 200 millimeters of mercury difference, well, let's show it for one. Let's show it for something.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. One of the ones the retina people talk about are the ones related to, like, how strong is the evidence that vitamins really help prevent, you know, age-related macular degeneration, dry AMD, and, you know, is there, you know, how important is zinc, how important are these, and you know, like, I'd love to see the raw data from the ARID studies and figure out if, you know, if my mom should be on PreserVision or not, you know, based on what the raw data looks like, because you just don't know. And you're right, there's financial pressures when you spend money, but there's also just, you know, just people wanting things to be a certain way. It's hard for people to change course. The people I've most admired in my career are the ones who've had a hypothesis and you show them something and you say, you know what, you were wrong. And they go, you know what, you're right. I was wrong. I look at this data, I'm wrong. And then they pivot and go, but there are very, very few people like that in the scientific world. Most people just latch onto a hypothesis sometimes early in their careers and do not want to let go regardless of what they see. You know, it's I'm sure you see that as well on the clinical side, and I see it on the clinical side too, where people, you know, will have certain experiences with certain products and they'll say, this is a good product, this is a bad product, based on you know, on And then they'll, and it'll be really, really hard to have them change their opinions on those products, regardless of what the future experience is or what other people tell them their experiences are.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just me, maybe it's my personality, but I'm not married to any one particular technique, device, product, or even belief. I'm fluid. I'm ready to change. I'm ready to, like, what do you got? What are you going to present me? Okay, let me check it out myself and let's go from there.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that I really, really respect about the cataract world, and I'm a cataract surgeon, not like you, but, you know, I do cataract surgery. I do it mostly on glaucoma people, but also I do some straight cataracts, is that in the cataract world, in the premium IOL cataract world, you have outcomes. Your ultimate outcome is patient happiness. Right. So what you're seeing is you have a toolkit. You have this bag of tricks you have, you know, whether it be, you know, EDOFs, multifocals, light adjustable, all these different options, femto, no femto. At the end of the day, when you're done with all that, you're going to have a customer, a patient, you know, who's going to say, you know, Dr. Dave Gunn, this really helped me. Or you're going to have a patient saying, I'm disappointed, right? So what the premium channel has done is allowed the cataract surgeon to have a conversation with the patient on ways that their lives can be improved, and then an opportunity to deliver. It's very, very different than the glaucoma world, because in the premium cataract world, the patients are actually paying. In the MIGS world, in the glaucoma surgery world, the insurance companies are paying. And the outcome is more nebulous because it's IOP, and you can always blame it on something else. You can all, you know, if the IOP goes high, despite you doing a MIGS procedure, the doctor can say, well, you know, we did the procedure, but your glaucoma is just so bad, your pressure still went up.
Right.
Or, you know, so, and ultimately, even IOP is not a symptomatic, most of the time is not symptomatic. So it's really like 5 years later, they lose their sight from a procedure or that was maybe didn't work versus they might've been able to preserve their vision by a procedure that did work, but there isn't that feedback that you get from a cataract patient. And so what we've seen in the glaucoma world is practice patterns are not driven necessarily by patient, by wanting to make the patient happy and say, Dr. Dave Gunn's the greatest, but really based on insurance trends. So for example, when you had the changes in stent reimbursement and you know, there was a very quick shift between implantable stents to the goniotomy procedures when there were these cuts. It was immediate, and I've written about this in a paper that was published in Ophthalmology last summer. Actually, I have to say a little, you know, just going to toot my horn a little bit. Russ Van Gelder chose it as one of the top papers in the ophthalmology family of journals. Because
I read it August 2024 in ophthalmology. I read it.
And so that's the difference, right? In glaucoma, people have been chasing the money because whoever pays for care controls that care. And the insurance companies have been controlling glaucoma care because when they alter reimbursement, the doctors sadly have followed what's happened. Whereas you can't do that in cataract surgery. If like somebody says, I'm going to pay you more for this lens than that one, and you start selling that lens because it's paid for more, even though it may not, there may not be evidence showing it works, your patients are going to be unhappy. They're going to go see somebody else who's going to give them what works, and your reputation, your business, and you know, will suffer, and you're not going to feel good about yourself. So I think we've got to get away from letting insurance companies dictate how we practice. And we got to fight back, you know, and we do have to fight the battles and say, look, you're not paying me enough for this. And you, but at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, it's got to be about doing what's right for the patient. And I think you guys as cataract surgeons have to do that because you can't survive without doing that. Whereas glaucoma docs, you know, like, you know, the question's still out whether everyone's doing that or not, because the data suggests that they're not, because they can't, you can't just completely shift what you're doing based on a reimbursement decision without any new data and feel that that's the right thing to do.
Well, the way you put it in a very succinct way in the article there in Ophthalmology, August 2024, you wrote there's transactional healthcare, like me taking my car to the mechanic, and then there's transformational healthcare. And we should opt for the latter, for the transformational healthcare, if we can.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, there was a letter to the editor in response to my paper saying, hey, the transactional method is the way to go. And, you know, like if it's just in a free market world, things work out. And I would just say that in general, you know, medicine has to be transactional. You know, if you provide a service, you need to get paid. But how much you get paid should not dictate what you do for a patient. Because at the end of the day, like if you practice that way, you can't feel good about yourself in the long run. Like, you know, and you certainly wouldn't want your family member's doctor, your doctor, to be practicing that way. You wouldn't want to go into have your heart or your lungs checked, or, you know, have your family members getting chemotherapy, having their treatment decisions being based on, you know, what the doctor's bottom line. And so why should ophthalmology be any different? Well, in cataract surgery, it can't be any different because the patient, you know, you have patients giving you feedback. In glaucoma, the patients sometimes don't have a voice. And this is what led me and a group of other people to develop a patient-reported outcome instrument for glaucoma, because there has to be some measure of what you're doing for them. If they can't tell you based on something that's very tangible, like, hey, doc, I can now read when I couldn't before your cataract surgery, or I can drive a car. If you don't have that kind of a metric with glaucoma, you need to find what the metric is, and you need to measure it. Like, are my eyes less red because I'm on fewer drops after this MIGS procedure? Or, you know, I'm not hitting cabinets with my head like my friend who had this other procedure, and there have to be outcomes, and oftentimes you have to resort to patient reported outcomes. So we did develop this instrument. Malvina Edelman at the FDA and I were co-principal investigators in a large effort that included the RAND Corporation down in your neck of the woods. Ron Hayes from UCLA, who's not an ophthalmologist, he's an internist who's a PRO expert. We had many other collaborators, you know, including MS, Verana. And this long 8-year project led to a patient-reported outcome instrument published in the AJO last summer. And we're hoping to have that available to the public. There's several organizations interested in hosting that tool. But the great thing about that will be, hey, if you have a new MIGS procedure or any kind of, you know, procedure for glaucoma, you can start looking at what it means for the patient as part of your trial. So in addition to collecting endpoints like IOP and visual fields and things like that, you can actually have a questionnaire from patients telling you how they're different from having had the surgery. And I think that's the future. That's a path forward for many diseases, including glaucoma.
So give me some examples. What are the points on the patient-reported outcome measure? What are we asking them?
Well, I think the big one for MIGS, and that was developed specifically for MIGS, it relate to eye drops. Because, you know, the real value proposition for MIGS is you have somebody with a cataract on glaucoma meds, and if you take out their cataract, you're going to get a pressure drop. Even if you just do a straight phaco, we know that. The data has been there a long time. If you do a phaco with a MIGS procedure, you get a bigger pressure drop. Okay. And the delta and the pressure drop actually doesn't translate necessarily into a pressure drop, but rather a reduction in the number of meds required to get to a certain pressure.
Right.
So in other words, we're going to treat to a pressure goal. Now, you know, what that goal is sometimes is not always clear, but say you've got a patient on two meds whose pressure is 15 before a phaco. And if you do a phaco MIGS and you get them down to one med, then the PRO instrument should be able to tell you what the benefit is of being on one less med. Like, your eyes aren't as red, they don't get as dry, you're putting less preservative in your so it's not, you know, it's not easy, but those are the lifestyle benefits of being of a reduction in medications. That's where the benefit is at that stage of the disease. Now, in the more advanced stages of disease, the benefit is prevention of blindness. I mean, if you've got a split fixation or encroaching on fixation visual fields, you know, the benefit is really, hey, if you get the pressure low enough and the disease is slowed low enough, you may have sight the rest of your lives. So, you know, definitely the stage of disease determines the impact that you'll have to measure for the patient. And that particular outcome instrument was for mild to moderate glaucoma. So the biggest impact is going to be the reduction in medicines.
Yeah, and that's a different way of thinking. I remember 15 years ago when MIGS first came out, and I looked at some of the original data on these early devices, and I was like, Okay, it's a millimeter of mercury lower for a year, and then kind of the effect wears off. I thought, that's not all that much. But then if you change the mindset of thinking about just IOP, which I was kind of fixated on, into like, okay, what's the medicine reduction, the drop reduction? That shows a little bit more clear data. But then again, are we just massaging the data?
Well, I think the data, actually, I think some of the mixed trials are actually some of the best trials that have been done in glaucoma, like the Horizon trial, for example, is one that I was involved in. There are others also, because the FDA demanded it. And so, there's no question that these procedures are beneficial. And the other thing is, there are tails when it comes to the effects, right? So even if the mean reduction is 1 or 2 millimeters, there's some people who get 4 or 5 or 6, right? And there are going to be some that get it more. And if for that individual patient, if they can get off, they're on 2 or 3 meds, get off all of them. And you might say, well, that's, even if that's just a small percentage, for if it's 10 or 20 or 30%, you've really helped those people. And as long as you haven't hurt the other 70%, in other words, you haven't, made their long-term visual acuity worse and with the cataract surgery, then you can justify that trade-off, even if the means don't look that good, saying, look, you might get lucky and hit a home run and be, off all your meds. But if you're not, you're still going to have good vision from your cataract surgery, and these MIGS are safe. So there's no downside. And that's why I think MIGS are good. They do help patients. But I think we should use them based on the data. We should use them based on how much they work, how well they've been studied, on safety and efficacy. We should not be using them based on, hey, what's getting paid for this week? and then when insurance companies push back, like they have in glaucoma, and they say, hey, we don't see enough data here. What we should do is say, you know what, you're right. We got to get more data. But give us some time. Let us work with you instead of just saying there's data when there isn't data. I think we should not, I think that's a losing proposition with CMS, because ultimately, people say, oh, they don't understand anything. This works. And I'm saying, well, if it works, you should be able to show it works. The other thing that I've been really kind of sad about is, because of this transactional way this our glaucoma field has emerged, is that there's less doctor curiosity. So, for example, a generation earlier, there were a bunch of trials looking at tubes versus trabs, right? The tube versus trabeculectomy study, the AMID barbell comparison, the primary TVT. And these studies were all done after these products were already available. And doctors, were looking at patients and saying, look, I want to know if Mrs. Jones needs this or that, or Mrs. Smith needs this or that. So I'm going to do a trial. These are procedures that are already reimbursed. So I don't actually have to bill a company for these procedures. I'm going to actually talk to a patient and say, look, I can do a trab or tube. If you're willing to be in the study, you're going to have one or the other, and we're going to bill your insurance company, because that's the standard of care. And so these were not expensive trials, because they weren't like, it wasn't like you're looking at novel treatments. It's doctors answering questions on what they should do for patients. I haven't seen those types of studies comparing the different stents and goniotomies and stuff, because it doesn't seem like the doctors are that curious anymore. They're going, for the most part, the Medicare data suggests they're going for whatever pays that time. And so that it's a little bit concerning that there isn't this interest in trying to find out what actually works better, or what you should use on your patients. We got to get back to that. We got to really get back to doing these types of studies. And then when we have the data from those studies, then we go to CMS and say, look, we just did a trial. This works. Here's the data. Now, at least pay us what we deserve for this. I think that's a better approach than just continuing to fight without the data and saying, we know more than you do. Leave us alone. And so it's a mindset, right?
But I mean, if you look at that for an example, then gosh, for the value that it brings, shouldn't cataract surgery be paying like 5 or 10 times what it pays now?
Well, come on. Like it's supposed to be effort too, right? I mean, I think to me, the biggest change, and there's 3 big things that have happened in my career as an anterior segment surgeon. One is the declining reimbursement for cataract surgery, the emergence of the premium channel, and then MIGS. Those are the 3 things, right?
Right.
And if you look at the first one, that is the reason why I think medicine has become more transactional. Because what's happened, because I remember the day when the guys that I trained with, some of my heroes, the Howard Fines of the world and others who I was influenced with early in my career, these guys, they did really well, right? Just doing standard cataract surgery. And because people did really well in that generation, they were willing to do a lot of other things where they didn't make money. Because they said, you know what, I'm doing really well. I'll take care of this ruptured globe. I'll take care of this. I'll do this because, you know what, at the end of the day, I'm doing well. And so the mindset was, maybe I get paid too much. They wouldn't say this, but maybe I get paid too much for some things that are easy. And I'll do the hard stuff because at the end of the day, I'm a doctor and it's my job to do the easy stuff and the hard stuff. Nowadays, when you squeeze people and you say, okay, this is the easy stuff, we're going to pay you less and less and less and less. At some point, Doc said, you know what? I'm not going to, like, you know, I'm not getting paid for the easy stuff. I don't want to do the hard stuff. You know, the system is going against me. I'm getting real money. I'm taking a cut every year. And, you know, docs have taken last 5 years. Docs have taken cuts in absolute terms, but then you count inflation, which has picked up again in real terms. They've really taken a hit. And so I don't necessarily blame the doctors completely. I blame some doctors who truly are just only transactional, but I think that's the minority. Most people do want to do good. But even some of the people who want to do good are looking at their bottom line saying, man, you know, I can't afford to do good for as much as I used to when things were better. And so it's a system, right? It's not any one group you can point to and say, and when people say, this next generation, they don't get it. They only care about this. You know, I think we have, if not the most competitive fellowship to get, one of the most competitive sought after fellowships in glaucoma. This year, the two fellows we got, both from UCSF, one has already got a job with the AAO when they're done at 50% and 50% at an academic place. The other is MD PhD from Harvard, who's a brilliant guy. You know, both of them are, people around the country have called and said, you got the two best guys in the country, the two best fellow applicants in the country. And, you know, both these guys, when I asked them, I said, you know, what attracted you to our program? And they both said, we want to learn the hard stuff. We want to learn trabeculectomy. We want to do hard cases. Mm-hmm. And so it made me realize that it's not this idea of these guys just want to be out windsurfing at 2 p.m. and make as much money as they can. They're not coming into training that way. At least the people I'm seeing aren't. Maybe they're going elsewhere. But when they get in, and it's mentorship, you know, how they're taught to practice, that's a big part of it. And the other part is financial pressures, you know, and those two things. So, of course, the elephant in the room here is private equity. So, you know, there are some top programs who've complained recently that they've had their graduates who are well-trained to take care of the hard stuff, want to take care of the hard stuff, join a private equity group where they're told you can't do these types of cases. This is not what you're going to do here. You're going to do this, this, and this. So it's really multifactorial. Why are fields there that way? My fear is that there could be a public health crisis in glaucoma because everyone seems to be wanting to take care, not everyone, but there are more people wanting to take care of glaucoma light because for the amount of time you put in, the reimbursement is better. Or the other way to put it is for the same amount of money, you have to do less work so you can do more. See more patients like that. So if everyone takes care of people who have light disease or no disease, and that's where all the money goes, that's where all the focus is at the big meetings, that's where all the banners are when you know, enter a big conference for all the people innovating in those products that are for mild disease, then there's going to be this subset of patients, you know, about 10% that have bad disease. And that group is not going to get cared for as well as they were in prior generations. So the irony of all this is more investment in glaucoma and more new products may actually be a distraction and may lead to greater glaucoma blindness. Right. And that was the reason for my editorial, because, you know, it was a message I wanted to get out there. So, and it wasn't one where in 20 years, I want to say I told you so. It was more like, hey, let's do something about this. Let's try to get people paid for the stuff that's the hard stuff. Let's, instead of like trying to get a little bit more for this easy stuff, or say, hey, we need protecting that being our primary focus because that's where the biggest numbers are. Let's also use some of that effort to try to, like, you know, just make sure resources are delivered to those people that are going to do badly. I'm reminded of a meeting. There's a guy, Tony Homer, who's a really prominent glaucoma specialist in Vienna. His dad, Tony's a big guy. I mean, he's the only guy I've seen eat 2 16-ounce steaks, like, you know, like side by side. I remember at McCormick and Schmidt in Chicago at the Academy, like he'd ordered, you know, the prime rib and the New York cut. He's about 300-pound, huge, strong, muscular guy. And his dad was kind of a smaller guy. And Tony had a huge meeting in Vienna and glaucoma. At the end of the day, his father got up from the back and he said, you know, at the end, there's you guys have wasted your time talking about glaucoma for 2 days, because there's only two types of glaucoma patients. The ones who do well no matter what you do to them, and the ones who do badly no matter what you do for them. Right. And, you know, now I don't think that's completely true, but there's an element of truth to that. Right. Because a lot of, and you know who they are. Like when they come into your practice, you know who they are. And what I don't want to happen is for that 10% that are destined to do badly, people just say, go somewhere else. Because part of the reason for the editorial was also I was starting to see more of these people that were bounced around, that nobody wanted to take care of. And they saw me about 5 years too late, when it was really too late to actually do anything. You know, once you lose central fixation and you needed a trab 5 years ago or a tube or something more definitive, and you just, you know, were bounced around and had one MIGS after the other, and ultimately nobody wanted to see you anymore, kind of breaks your heart, right? I mean, because that some of these people, you know, there were people that could have been saved, and they weren't.
You know, I think for the young generation, they're smarter than I ever was at that age.
Yeah.
So if I was applying for ophthalmology residency today, I'd be doing family practice. There's no way I'd get it. The new generation.
Not true, my friend. Not true. You would have, in any arena, you would have risen to the top.
Well, I appreciate that. But the new generation, I think, is just trying to survive. You know, I used to work with, many years ago, an ophthalmologist who's since passed. He'd passed well into his 80s. He said in the 1980s, when he first started in cataract surgery, he put it in a neat way. He said he had to do 6 or 7 cataracts through Medicare to be able to buy the base level Ford F-150 pickup truck. And he says the number now, before he passed, this was maybe like 5 years ago, he says now he has to do 120 phacos to buy the base Ford F-150 pickup truck. So he says, it's not that my reimbursement has been cut by, you know, 70, 89%. No, it's been cut like 98%. It's crazy.
Yeah, you know, and I do think that the impact of that is tremendous. And it's not just specific to cataract surgery or even ophthalmology. It's true throughout medicine. When you take people's bread and butter that they're making a living on, and you keep cutting it every year, at some point the doctors get frustrated and they're not willing to do the things that they don't have to do. It becomes us versus you. And the quote I used in my editorial was, there's a war being waged. There's really a gun battle, not a gun battle, but a battle war being waged between payers and providers, and the patients are caught in the middle. You know, they're caught in the middle because the doctors are angry at the insurance companies. Insurance companies are angry at the doctors, and they're going back and forth. And ultimately, there's a patient there that needs to be taken care of. And all of this energy and, you know, bad feelings that are going back and forth, there's no way the patient can be completely immune from that. You know, it rubs off. It's not just the vibe. It's also from a practical standpoint, it results in worse care. And you're seeing a lot of anger being demonstrated by patients towards insurance companies. And so, you know, we've certainly seen this play out over the last few months, you know, in a very violent way in New York City, and the social media stuff that followed. Who could have predicted that, right? I mean, what came about as a result of that situation? But there has to be a fix. And then the other piece, of course, is healthcare just keeps getting more and more expensive, and it's not clear we're delivering better care. But I'm very, very pleased that there is this premium channel in cataract surgery, because it allows the doctor to offer a service to patients, and it's not for not every patient will, you know, want to go ahead with something like this, but you know, it gives you this opportunity, and oftentimes these are some of the happiest patients out there, that, you know, it's probably the best $3,000 or $5,000 or $7,000 they spent, if you ask them later, I've had a great outcome. And you could say, well, they would have done fine with just a standard lens and they didn't need this, but at the end of the day, you know, the patients are making these decisions, and I wish we had something similar in glaucoma where we could actually deliver to patients and have them thank us, and hopefully that motivates doctors to do what's good for patients instead of just trying to play this game with insurance companies. And again, it's not everybody. There are many, many people who are doing what's best for patients all the time. It's just the data just sticks out at you when you look at what happens to utilization when reimbursement changes in our field, and it's just scary.
You know, I think you hit the nail on the head. I want to put my patient first. And I use a saying that you use. We think the same way. If this patient was my father, brother, son, daughter, wife, what would I do for this patient? You're my family. What am I going to do for you? And that's the treatment I'm going to give you. But the issue then, you have these big groups, the private equity groups, and then the doctors, merely employees, clocking in, clocking out. The private equity group saying, no, we put our stockholders first. Above the patients, above the physicians, above the community, it doesn't matter. And then you have this issue. And the study you're talking about, I think, was sometime in 2022, where the insurance company decided that they're not going to pay as much for angle-based implants. And now all of a sudden, like virtually overnight, now there's a lot more volume of goniotomy procedures.
Yeah. And yeah, that's right. And big drop in stents. And Mark Jusich's group at Wayne State, actually, this really helped, you know, my editorial was the fact that they actually published a paper in the Journal of Glaucoma that showed that trend. And it was remarkable how quickly it happened. Right. Now, for us, one of the disturbing features was that that was the time we were actually validating the PRO instrument that we had developed with the FDA. Mm-hmm. And almost immediately, our enrollment went down remarkably, and we actually had to delay completion of the tool. We, you know, after we completed the PRO instrument and did several iterations, the final version was field tested at about 20 sites around the U.S. where they were actually doing phacoimplantable MIGS that were FDA approved, and were then doing the PRO questionnaire to see how it impacted their lives. And people wrote to us and said, you know, we're not going to be doing this procedure anymore. Like, we're thinking, okay, well, you know, like, and we're going to be doing goniotomy, which wasn't in the study. And that's what led me to realize, hey, you know, like, there are people who were probably, you know, signed up for these procedure, maybe had the flu and came back a few weeks later and were rescheduled and were told, we're going to do something different for you now, you know, than the mm-hmm. other one. And, you know, there probably were examples of that where, if practices completely abandoned things, procedures based on reimbursement. And the other piece, of course, was that for those stents, the facility fees stayed high. And so the other piece of that is there were docs who owned their surgery centers. They were perhaps more likely to continue with the stents because they were making up whatever they lost in physician fees with facility fees, the ones who weren't. And so that shouldn't be the reason why things are happening in the world. What should be the reason things should be happening is doctor says, I'm going to do this for you because based on what you've told me, this is what would help you the most. Mm. And this is, and in the cataract world, you have that ability to have the conversation and then have an opportunity to deliver what you said you would deliver. And at the end, the patient will be the judge of whether what you said was going to happen actually happens. And I know cataract surgeons who guarantee the results, who actually say, look, if you do have a bad refractive outcome, we'll take care of it because, you know, you're paying for this premium service and we'll do that. And like, you know, I don't even know how you would do that in the glaucoma, in the insurance company controlled glaucoma world, you know, where you could do something like that. So I'm in some ways envious of, you know, what you do. I mean, I'm part of that cataract world. I've been an Aspirus member my whole career. I mean, I feel like, you know, that's very much part of my world. I've certainly done far more cataract surgeries than I've done glaucoma surgeries in my career. And that's just because of the numbers. There's far more people needing cataracts. But it's, you know, it's frustrating, but the challenge is one I think we can overcome as a community, and it'll just require us coming together and like not, you know, and then also being independent voices, not feeling the pressure, not just the financial pressures of the what the insurance put on us, but also what the companies can sometimes do as well. So, you know, one of the problems I think now is that when new things come out, there are young glaucoma doctors who are very visible nationally and internationally, not just young, older glaucoma doctors, who are what I call early adopters. Huge difference between an early adopter and an innovator. Okay. Many awards at big meetings are given to people who claim to be innovators when all they are really, they think, okay, what did you actually develop? Well, you know, you didn't really develop anything, but you were the first person to do the first 100 of these, the first 100 of these. Anybody gives you, do them.
Right.
To me, that's not an innovator. An innovator is somebody who actually creates something, you know, actually does something new. It's not someone who just says, hey, you know, I mastered this thing before anyone else tried it.
Right.
You know, somebody else. And so I think what's happened is there's pressure on these people to make it on lists of being top docs or whatever, or just be in the good graces of companies to try new things. And so there was a quote that I talked about in one of my lectures where there's someone talking, someone says something to the effect that our biggest challenges with all the new procedures that have come out, finding patients who meet the criteria for these procedures. So, which to me is backward medicine, right?
Right.
I mean, the biggest challenge should be, there's a patient in front of you, what should I do for them?
Right.
It shouldn't be, hey, this new device came out, I need to find people in my practice that meet the criteria because it pays X thousand for each one.
Right.
Or if I do enough of these, I'm going to get the innovator award at the next meeting, or I'll be on the list of the top 100 ophthalmologists in the world because, you know, I'll be flown all over the world to show people how to do this. And, you know, so the pressure put on these young people to become famous by just shoving stuff down people's throat, like, you know, really just saying, I got to, you know, in many ways, the patients can become victims in this kind of world. They come in and they somehow meet the criteria for something. It may not be in their best interest, but they somehow meet the criteria. And if the doctor's primary focus is, hey, you know, based on either their own needs for glory, their own bottom line, or their private equity company saying, you need to do 40 of these this year, like, or whatever, to make it worthwhile for us to keep you employed, whatever that motivation is, that's backward medicine. And so another way that innovation, you know, can not always move the needle forward. And but man, you've been an innovator, man. I mean, when I watched
you, I'm an early adopter.
You may be, I don't know whether you're an early adopter or not, but you're certainly an innovator, because the way you look at your field, the way you look at cataract surgery, you're looking for things, signs, certainly signs and symptoms of things going wrong, which is a big part of cataract coach. But also, hey, how do we prevent this from happening? How do we fix this? It's a mindset. People who are innovators have a mindset, and you have that mindset, you know? And so that's another thing I'm envious of, because I don't necessarily see myself. I mean, in my own very small world of doing a lot of trabeculectomies, I try to tweak things and do the little things that make it better, but you've done it on a much bigger scale. But I do think we have to delineate between those people and make sure we reward the true innovators, the ones who actually are doing the innovation, because they're the ones that, you know, should get the credit.
I'm just a curious guy. I just want to learn everything. So, you know, a cataract coach, I get 30 to 50 videos sent to me a week. I watch all of them. It's like the best one to show on Cataract Coach. And it's really, I promise, I've learned way more than I've taught. And I saw a need. I saw a need a few years ago. In fact, we were 2,500 videos in. So 2,500 days ago, maybe 2018, seven-ish years ago, I said, can I improve the way that surgery is taught worldwide? That's the challenge. And then I said, well, okay, maybe I'll make a video a week. And then I said, no. Can I hold myself to a higher standard? Can I do a video a day? And then I said, you know, I'm just going to do it. And the first couple hundred videos, I thought I was just talking to myself. I would like force my residents to watch it. And so I'd get like a few hits. And I didn't realize it'd grow this fast. So now we're more than 1 million views a month.
Wow.
It's crazy.
Well, I'll tell you.
And that's why I take all the selfies.
Yeah. I'll tell you that is a privilege, right? I mean, medicine already selects the best and brightest. And then you go into ophthalmology, you know, the people that we interface with in our worlds are the greatest. And if they are able to share with us, I mean, we learn so much more than we can ever teach them from the collective wisdom of all the people we interact with. I share this great story with you.
Tell me.
There was a university president of a big university, actually the biggest university in the world, with the largest budget in the world, who we recently honored at a meeting. I won't mention his name because maybe he doesn't want me to tell the story, or maybe he does. Who used to be president of another big university that had a very prominent football team. In fact, that football team just won the national title.
Okay.
and he said, every year our team would play a smaller school in the same state. And we played them in football. And when I was president of the university, we'd be out, you know, I'd be out on the field and we'd beat these guys really badly, but the other university would play us, because every other year we'd play at their place and they'd sell out because we were visiting and we were the, you know, one of the top football programs in the country. And they could probably tell recruits that, hey, you know, if you come to our university, we play this great school every year and maybe the scouts will see you. But he said while he was out there, he realized that the other team they were playing, he said it was almost as if it was like a schoolyard game where two guys picked teams, and the first one had the first 85 choices.
Oh, boy.
And then the next person got everyone else. And it was, he said, he realized that there wasn't a single person on the other team that could have made our team. Not one of them would have made our team. Right. And there's not a single person on our team that would have ever even considered playing for that other team. Because if they hadn't played for us, they'd play for Notre Dame or Penn State or Oklahoma or somebody else. It was a ridiculous mismatch. You know, score was 63-0 or whatever. And he said, like, my whole career, I felt like I've gone through my career as if I had the first 85 picks. And everyone says, you're so brilliant. You're such a great teacher. And you're so amazing. And I realize that it's because all these people that I have access to or who listen to me or I have an opportunity to mentor are the best and brightest people. Mm. And so it makes me look a lot better than I am. And I think I certainly feel like, you know, in the world that I live in, the world you live in, we all feel that these people that, you know, that we interact with are making us better and make us look better than we are. In your case, though, you have provided something really special. And I think your talents as a communicator, as a surgeon, as a doctor, for sure. But also as someone who is able to see the big picture and bring people in, you know, this openness, this inclusion is unique to have all those skill sets. So when you said, hey, can I be on your podcast can you be on my podcast? I jumped to it because, man, it's a pleasure to spend time with you today. And, you know, it's been a fun 30 years hanging with you. I still remember the first time we met 20, 25 years ago in New Orleans, the Academy. I think we shared a cab together to a downtown hotel. And I said, man, this guy's got a lot of energy. I'm going to hang with him as much as possible.
I know, amazing how the years go by. But again, it's that mentorship. It could be as random as meeting someone in a cab at an Academy meeting. But then that turns to a friendship or even a mentorship or brotherhood that lasts for decades. It's amazing.
Absolutely true. And you never know where it's coming from. And this idea of continuing to develop these non-transactional relationships where you run into somebody and say, I'll give you one last example. Sure. Of this. I give a talk on this to undergraduates in college about how, you know, just make as many non-transactional relationships as you can. So I go play. I play tennis in college, and I'm kind of an old hacker now. But I go to the Stanford tennis wall, and I teach. I sometimes will teach my daughter to play. You know, back in the day, I used to teach her. But well, sometimes I have no one to hit with. I'll hit against the wall. And one day, this 16, 17-year-old kid had his hand bandaged, was hitting balls with his mother. His mother was feeding him balls, and he was hitting them. And he looked like a pretty good player, even with the bandage on his hand.
Right.
And so I went up to him and I said, look, I got no one to hit with. You want to hit? You know, and like, I'd say about 70% of the time when they see an older guy do that, the person, nah, I'm okay, leave me alone, or I'm going to go soon, or whatever. So this guy said, you know, like, yeah, what the heck? So you probably realize, you know, I don't have to necessarily do this for a long time. So we started hitting some balls, and it turned out that we hit pretty well. Make a long story short, the guy ended up coming to Stanford as a recruit. He was a top 5 player in the country, full scholarship Stanford, played on the team. And ended up during medical school, he wrote to me and said, look, I want to be a doctor. So we ended up meeting and I ended up becoming good friends with this guy. He ended up going to Penn for medical school, and he's currently a Jules Stein ophthalmology resident. Now, likelihood of this guy having gone into ophthalmology, if he had said no to me when I asked him to hit those tennis balls, was probably pretty low. But the fact that he was surrounded, and he ended up becoming good friends with my friend Jeff Tabin, who I introduced him to.
Sure.
And we ended up having a tennis, we used to do all this stuff together. And over time, David, he at that time when I met him, we had no knowledge or interest in ophthalmology at that time. But over time, that relationship developed. And so I tell people, like, you know, so when someone asks you to do something, Like, and if it's not going to kill you to do it, just do it. Just do it. Make that relationship. You never know. 9 out of 10 times it may lead to nothing, but once in a while it may completely transform your life. And for me, another one related to that was I was having lunch in the Johns Hopkins cafeteria as a medical student. And I was getting ready to apply in the internal medicine match. And this high school kid was sitting there and he sat down, he struck up a conversation and he told me, he said, you know, I don't think you should go into internal medicine. This is like a high school kid telling me. I said, how come? He goes, well, my dad's an ophthalmologist and he loves it and it's great. And I said, who's your dad? He goes, it's Al Sommer. And I said, your dad's Al Sommer? He goes, yeah. I said, I've heard of your dad. He goes, you should meet him. So I went and met with Al, and Al said, hey, why don't you do an MPH and you can do this preventive ophthalmology fellowship with us. And Al paid for my MPH. He paid for my Wilmer fellowship. And I pulled out of that medicine match and went and became an ophthalmologist based on, you know, eating collard greens in the Hopkins cafeteria where some young kid just struck up a conversation. Completely changed my life, right?
That's so amazing.
And I know so many people who have these kinds of stories. And this idea of just sitting in your phone in your dorm room and just doing social media and stuff, and not getting out there and having these interactions and letting them develop into relationships, that's killing society. And it's hurting young people. They need to get out there. And you and I think, are good examples of extroverts who make these relationships that have opened doors for us and led to these enriching experiences that, you know, many people, I feel bad for the people that don't have those experiences.
I do too. So I agree with you. You're saying, just say yes, take a chance. Don't say no.
Do it. You can always, if you don't like it, you can always say after 5 minutes, you can say, man, you really suck. You're a terrible tennis player. I'm not going to hit with you anymore. Or you could just say, like, my mom has to go. She's got to. But, you know, these taking these chances, just opening yourself up to possibly being bored for a few minutes with the
possibility,
it's a commitment.
Absolutely. Wow, that is amazing. Well, thank you for saying yes to doing this podcast. I want to tell you that I can't believe it's already been an hour of us chit-chatting. So thank you again for doing this podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Uday. Be well. All the best, my friend.
Thank you so much. And I remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new podcast every single Sunday. Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, wherever you get your podcast, you'll find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, new Cataract Coach video every single day. And now we even have a new retina video at retinarounds.com every single day. Check it out.